Coming up on Broadway Radios this week on Broadway, we talk with Karen Ziemba. We also hear about Peter's review of The Bridges of Madison County, New York Philharmonic's production of Sweeney Todd, Tenderloin at the York Theatre Company, Jim Caruso's cast party, and Little Mary Sunshine at Musicals Tonight. So please stay tuned.
His hope was there, and never come again.
Easy now. Hush, love, hush. I keep telling you.
Wait.
What you rush.
Why did I wait? You told me to wait. Now he'll never come again. There's a hole in the world like a great black pit, and it's filled with people are filled with shit, and the vomit of the world inhabits it. They all deserve to die. Tell you why, Mrs. Lovitz, tell you why. Because in all of the whole human race, Mrs. Lovitz, there are two kinds of men and only two. There's the one staying put in his proper place, and the one with his foot in the other one's face. Look at me, Mrs. Lovitz, look at you.
Hello and welcome to Broadway Videos this week on Broadway for Sunday, March 9th, 2014. My name is James Marino, and in the broadcast this morning, we have Michael Portantier and Peter Felicia. Peter is a theater journalist and historian with a number of books, his most recent being Stripper, Showgirls, and Sharks. His columns appear at MTI, Critchland, Masterworks, Broadway, and many other places. Good morning, Peter.
Hi.
Welcome back from your trip to Cincinnati.
Thank you. God love you.
How'd you do there? You saw Les Mis?
I saw Les Mis three times with two different casts. Well, two different Valjeans and two different Javerts. Once again, an amazing production. They just do spectacular work. No turntable, no, but nevertheless, a lot of innovative ideas, including having Marius see those empty chairs at those empty tables filled with the ghosts of the people who were killed. So they weren't empty chairs realistically, but they were empty chairs in the sense that he was imagining those guys being there. So Aubrey Berg always does terrific work, and he didn't disappoint there, and the kids sang it beautifully, and the best sound design I probably ever heard anywhere. So quite a couple of days in Cincinnati.
You know, Lauren Kennedy, alumni of Cincinnati, she started a theater down in North Carolina, is it?
Yeah, right, yeah.
And they just did...
Les Mis
down there, and Lauren's daughter played. Cosette Arepinin, yeah, but she used her in the poster. It was stunning. The photography for the poster.
I'm glad you told me that. I'll look for that.
It's that's her daughter. That's featured in the poster. It's
and Lauren herself was Fantine, wasn't she?
Yes,
yeah,
exactly.
Okay. Uh huh.
So we have to see if we'll get Lauren on the show.
She's a terrific young woman.
All right. So also with us is Michael Portantier. Michael is a theater reviewer and essayist whose work appears at Talkin' Broadway, the Sondheim Review, and Broadway Stars. He's also a photographer whose work can be seen at followspotphoto.com as well as many of the places on the internet. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning.
And Michael, you got a chance. Actually, you and Peter both got a chance to see... this incredible, what is it, a concert or a production of Sweeney Todd?
Yes, the staged concert version of the show presented by the New York Philharmonic of Sweeney Todd. And let me tell you, his skin was pale and his eye was odd. Well, it was very much a staged concert version of the show, the piece presented by the New York Philharmonic, who had done it some years ago with the same director, Lonnie Price. This one was completely reconceived in terms of the direction, the staging, the concept. So that's interesting. I kind of expected maybe to see a recreation of the first staging, but not by any means. And I would say for better or worse, there were many things in it I did not like in terms of the staging, but there were some really interesting things too. For example, one that leaps to mind is the parlor songs in Act Two. There's a point where the beadle comes in to Mrs. Lovett's pie shop, and he sits down at an organ and he starts playing these songs and singing these old style parlor songs. And in the original version, he sings like two or three of them, and it does get a little tiring after a while. But what they did here was that they cut some of it, I think, but they did have him sing the first song, and then they had him sing the second song. But to make it more interesting, what the staging was that he got Mrs. Lovett to sit down at the harmonium. I think it's supposed to be a harmonium. And then the Beatle kind of stood behind her and put his arms around her and played the harmonium, like, as if while embracing her, you know, just to up the sleaze factor of the Beatle, as if there wasn't enough already. But that just made it, you know, interesting, and you still got to hear the song rather than him just sitting there playing it. So I thought that was really intelligent. And there was some other... there were some other things that I didn't necessarily agree with. The opening, this production will be finished as of the time we're recording this, or at least as of the time it's released. So I guess there won't be a spoiler. Something that a lot of people really loved in the staging was that at the beginning, all of the principals came out in complete formal wear of the type that you would see in a concert of a regular opera. Or Beethoven's Ninth or whatever, and with music stands next to them. And it looked like they were going to prepare to do the whole show that way. But then the music started, and gradually people started, like, knocking over the music stands and ripping off their jackets. And it was, to sort of reflect the anarchy, I guess, of what was about to happen. And it was interesting, and the audience laughed. I'm not sure laughter at that point in the show is really what we're going after, so that's why I have my questions about that bit of staging. It was interesting, but I'm not sure if ultimately it's what we want. I think we're supposed to kind of have that feeling of dread right from the beginning. And then after that, certainly there are many, many comic moments. But anyway, that's what I thought about that. The cast, the two leads were so spectacular that some really, really questionable casting in the other roles didn't seem to matter anywhere near as much. Bryn Terfel was supposed to be Sweeney Todd the first time that the Philharmonic did this piece some years ago, and he backed out, I think, like maybe a week or two ahead of time because he had injured his back, if I recall correctly. And the Philharmonic reached out to George Hearn, who already at the time was, I believe, 70 years old, or maybe even a few years beyond that. And he came in and did an incredible job of saving the show and doing himself proud, even at that advanced age, singing beautifully and acting as incredibly as ever. So he and Patti LuPone were quite a team in that production. But here, Bryn Terfel, he later got to do it elsewhere. I know he did it in Chicago Lyric Opera, and then I think maybe one other production at least somewhere. And if you go to YouTube, you can find several clips of him as Sweeney Todd. So you can do that if you missed this Philharmonic production live. But also, you're eventually going to see this production. You're going to get to see it on PBS because it was filmed for that. And in fact, at the performance that I attended last night, there were lots of cameras swirling around on stage, like on in the wings of the stage primarily. So it looks like they're really doing it up. But anyway, Bryn Terfel sang the role better than you will ever hear anyone sing it. And, you know, with all due respect to Len Carew and George Hearn and everyone else, it's just a different type of voice. Acting not as specific, I would say, as those gentlemen, but also Terfel's physical presence. He's a huge man. Is just so overwhelming that I think the character really came through, even if there might be specific moments and line readings that you know are maybe not ideal, and we would all agree with. Emma Thompson was triumphant. She, everyone expected, I'm sure, her acting to be superb. Her Cockney accent sounded 100% authentic to me. And on top of that, her singing, not in her upper register, which was rather weak, and I think partly because just she hasn't not used it. But her lower register, she sang as well as many other musical theater stars I can think of. She sang so well, as I said to a friend of mine, that you would think that was that has been her career. I mean, it wasn't just getting by. It was a really strong, warm, communicative sound. And I think everyone was blown away. Really, it was something else. The orchestra, of course, sounded magnificent. I should note it was not the full Philharmonic. I don't think it probably was last time either, because the full Philharmonic, I think, is about 80 players. And it looked to me like this was more like 50 or maybe 60 at most. But it's still, you know, I mean, it's twice the size, at least, of any Broadway orchestra you'll hear nowadays, two or three times the size. And Alan Gilbert conducted really just very well, as well as Paul Gemignani, which is the highest praise I can give. And those incredible Jonathan Tunick orchestrations, I could just listen to them forever. We were lucky enough to have Erin Mackey on the podcast last week. She played Joanna. And I have to say that she was the best of the featured players. Just her voice was glorious, and she gave a very different, stronger interpretation to the character, and she was spot on 100% of the time. The other featured players, in one way or another, I have to say, although they had their many moments, they were all miscast to one degree or another. Jeff Blumenkrantz just does not have the voice for the Beatle, as I feared, you know, when I heard that he was cast. But I thought, well, you know, maybe I haven't heard him sing that type of music, and maybe he's got more than I realize. No, sorry, did not have the high notes, and not the quality that's required. Christian Borle is a slightly different case, because he played Pirelli, and Pirelli does have some very famous, very, very high notes in the show, but it's really only about two or three of them. But on the other hand, they are very important, even though, you know, it's not so much quantity as quality, because they come at very dramatic moments. So he sounded great in 95% of the role. And of course, his acting and his Italian accent were hilarious. But when he went up to those notes, those two or three notes, it was a real disappointment. So I'm not sure that was the best idea to get him as opposed to someone else for that part. And then Jay Armstrong Johnson also sounded great in his lower and middle registers for the most part, but he had this very, very annoying habit of singing straight tone high notes, which is absolutely not what was called for and was written, and it didn't sound good to me at all. He and Jeff Blumenkrantz they really almost, I'm not going to say ruined, but they almost ruined the quartet because their voices weren't up to it. And the other two in the quartet, Erin Mackey and Philip Quast, were great at it, but they could only do so much. The very young person who played Tobias, just there are problems when you cast that role with a very young man or boy, and the size of the voice wasn't quite up to it, and the articulation of the text, it just seemed not really what we wanted. And then the beggar woman was played on the night I saw it by Brianna Marie Parham, and I just thought that there was a lot of overacting, and so much so that she was singing off pitch in many points, because trying to be desperate and to be a really desperate beggar woman. And there's an interesting thing there. When this production was done some years ago, Audra McDonald came in as a favor, or I guess, to Lonnie Price to be the beggar woman. So that was like really kind of star stunt casting. And she, this time, did some of the performances, but not all of them. So I don't know what that's all about. It seems a little odd to me because this was five performances over 4 days, and she couldn't do all of them. Maybe she had a previous conflict or one of the nights. I don't know. But at any rate, she didn't sing on Saturday. But Brianna Marie Parham is also African-American. And it's like I thought to myself, well, that's funny. I mean, when he cast Audra McDonald, it was presumably because she was Audra. And so it was colorblind casting. But to go out of your way and stick to that for that one role, to have an African-American as the beggar woman in this production seemed really, really interesting and kind of strange to me, especially because if I recall correctly, in the original production, we see that little mime scene of Lucy, Sweeney's wife, in a flashback, while Mrs. Lovett is singing Poor Thing and explaining what happened to her. And I'm pretty sure that when Audra McDonald did it, she played Lucy there, and then she was revealed to be Lucy, of course, at the end of the piece, presumably on the idea that everyone knew the piece anyway, and so we didn't need that horrible moment of surprise. But in this production, young Lucy was played by a non-African-American person in the chorus, and then suddenly she was Brianna Marie Parham. So there were some jokes from the audience, certain people in the audience, about that, and I'm not sure why that was done. Very scattershot direction, smart things followed by dumb things, I would say, all night. But what a masterpiece this is, and played so beautifully. We've seen and heard it so often over the past few years in every possible, an intimate Broadway version with the actors playing the instruments, a big, huge film version with many voices that should not have attempted it, but with the original orchestrations retained and some music cut. What else have we seen? I mean, it's been on in opera houses. It's so malleable. And as I went with Gerard Alessandrini, who happened to be in town, and he said, it really is a tribute to the piece, and you can do it so many different ways. You could do it small, you can do it medium, you can do it large, and you can give it a concept, and it always works because it's the music and lyrics are just beyond brilliant.
So, Peter, what did you think about it?
Well, if I had gone first, I would have gone to the exact same thing that Michael mentioned, and that is the Beatle coming on to Mrs. Lovett. I thought that was a really sharp idea.
Yeah.
So I'm delighted that it struck him that way, too. I have to say I like the idea of the people coming out in formal dress and standing in front of music stands and leading me to believe. Because I hadn't read that much about it, leading me to believe that it was going to be that type of concert. Fine, I accepted that. And then to have those books thrown on the floor and the music stands tossed over, I thought was a terrific idea, because I love when a director can come up with an idea that anybody could have come up with years and years and years and years ago. And that's what applies here with Lonnie Price's direction. I thought it was a triumph. And I liked the supporting cast substantially more than Michael did. So I really thought it was terrific all around. And this is a piece I never tire of. I do have two observations of a different kind. One, I remember when the book Sondheim and Company first came out, which was, I guess, in the mid-70s. And Leonard Bernstein was quoted there saying, "Someday Steve is going to write an opera and he is going to knock your ears out," something like that. Well, that turned out to be true, because this is it. This is the one that Bernstein had predicted. And it was nice, to say the least, that Mr. Sondheim came through on that promise that Leonard Bernstein had made about him. The other thing I want to talk about in terms of non-traditional casting, a historical note, because I was reminded of it when Michael was talking about Audra being replaced by Brianna. Back in 1964, there was a big deal made of a play called The Owl and the Pussycat. Reason was that Alan Alda was cast opposite Diana Sands. Now, Diana Sands was the original Beneatha in A Raisin in the Sun. She was a black actress. And the point is, when Bill, Manhoff, wrote this play, he did not write it for a black actress. He simply wrote it for a white actress. But the point is, Diana Sands came in, auditioned, they liked her best, and they cast her in the role. And this was a big thing at the time about how, isn't it wonderful that this role has been cast irrelevant to race? I mean, isn't it terrific that finally somebody can get a role without any reference to race whatsoever? So then the National Touring Company goes out. Who gets the part? Eartha Kitt. I mean, to me, that defeats the whole purpose of this. You know, suddenly it became a black role. I'll grant you, you know, that when the movie was made, Barbara Streisand plays it. And it but nevertheless, for that moment in time, in 1965-66, suddenly it was a case that what had been a non-specific role for an actress suddenly turned very specific in terms of race. So I was thinking of that as well. I had a wonderful time at the Sweeney, Todd. I thought a lot of the staging was very good under the circumstances. I enjoyed seeing a chorus of so many people up there, including Eddie Corbett was in it, which was very nice. Mm. It's good seeing because he's such an interesting looking person. And so I thought it was pretty triumphant. And my hats off to everybody involved for doing such a wonderful job with the Sweeney Todd. So it's funny because Michael said, you know, it's not a spoiler because it's over today. But then, you know, I didn't realize it was being PBS'd. So I guess we have spoiled, but I guess it'll take so long for it to show up on PBS that we'll have forgot that part that we gave away. So
do you mean what we're talking about, the staging things or the fact of who the beggar woman turns out?
No, the staging. No, it was funny, you know, because I had heard some people say, oh, I bet it's going to be Elaine Stritch. you know, and
that would have been good.
And, you know, I don't know if Stritch is up to it at this point in time, but nevertheless, it's certainly a role that she'd be terrific for. But I did see Audra, by the way, Michael, and she really threw herself into this role. She was having a wonderful time doing it, and the audience had a wonderful time watching her. So,
well, she did it, as it said, she did it. Was it 10 years ago?
15? I think so, but maybe.
And there is an audio recording of that, not a video. There is a video of the equivalent production when it went to the San Francisco Opera, but in that one, it's Victoria Clark as the
best. Yes, right. Yeah. Well, you know, the only other thing I'm going to mention is Bryn Terfel. You know, I worry sometimes when opera singers go into musical theater. Granted, this is a hybrid of sorts, but nevertheless, I worry about that because so many times they want to show off their capital B, capital V, beautiful voices. And that didn't quite happen here. There were times when it threatened to, but he really played the character as opposed to just saying, can you believe what a magnificent instrument I have, you know. And you know, we've all heard opera singers just do that when they come into musical theater. You know, now we're going to show them what beautiful voices are, because so many voices in musical theater aren't nearly as beautiful as ours. So the character often suffers. It didn't happen here. There were times I thought it would. It didn't. Mm. So my hat's off to him for doing it right, and my hat's off to Lonnie Price for making sure that didn't happen.
I think I think neither one of us mentioned Philip Quast, and we definitely should. He was quite amazing as the judge. Although, what do you think about this, Peter? I thought he was too attractive.
Oh, that's funny.
He didn't get a laugh when he had that wonderful line about Joanna. You know, he's asked Joanna to marry him, and he says, "Strange. When I offered myself to her, she showed a bit of reluctance."
Yeah. See, even if he's a good-looking man, it's the age thing that makes.
Oh yeah.
You know. So as a result, that didn't strike me the way it struck you.
Well, the age thing and also the fact that he's been functioning as a parental figure.
Sure, sure.
But my point is that I did notice that the audience did not laugh, and that always usually gets a laugh when it's, you know, some old guy with a white beard and stooped over, and, you know. So I did, you know, I guess you could do it both ways.
Well, it may very well be they did laugh because everybody knows this show, chapter and verse, who was there. That could be, too. So, nevertheless... I'm afraid old age is enough to discourage a woman from saying, "Wow, oh, Judge, you and me, oh, let's go." You know,
but what I mean, it was really an amazing night. I last night, Sondheim was also there. Victor Garber was there. John Hamm and his wife, Harvey Evans, Pamela Myers. It was, you know, it was obvious that this was something that people really, really wanted to see. Peter mentioned the ensemble. I mean, some of the names I'm just realizing now. George Lee Andrews was in. Bradley Dean, Eddie Corbett, as Peter mentioned. I mean, I think everyone wanted Karen Murphy. I think everyone wanted to be involved or see it. And, you know, I cannot certainly understand why. And everyone, you know, you will get your chance to see, if you agree with what we said about it, when it's on PBS, although I think that may not be till later into the spring when they have a, you know, pledge drive. Yeah.
So, Michael, Peter, actually, before we get off of Sweeney Todd, I wanted to ask you a question. Given that we talk about the masterpiece that Sweeney Todd is, and how many different productions we do see of it on a regular basis around Broadway and across the rest of the world, you know, do you think that it's you know, in 100 years time we can consider, you know, the Stephen Sondheim like the Shakespeare of our time?
Oh, easily. I think his work will endure tremendously. And no matter what it is, a lot of people tell me that they feel company is dated. Aside from perhaps the pot smoking scene, I don't see it at all. I think that husbands and wives will always be sorry grateful, so I think that one will last. But I can't imagine that his work will fall out of favor at all, and that it's too intelligent. And when we have a musical theater renaissance where intelligence is prized again, I really believe that he'll be more popular than ever.
So, Michael?
Well, I totally agree, except that my only proviso is that if indeed there continues to be what many people perceive as a dumbing down of the general population, if that is in fact what's happening, then I would say, unfortunately, that fewer people will appreciate his work in the future than do now. And maybe fewer people appreciate it now than before, although I'm not sure about that. You know, he's gotten so many revivals and so much attention, deservedly so. I think that a lot of people no longer accept the ridiculous statement that he can't write a melody. You know, it's all about being able to appreciate that kind of achievement, the kind of incredible achievement of lyric writing and musical composition. So as long as people are able to appreciate those two things, his stuff will remain immortal. And it is, I've said this before, it's so interesting. I would say, I would have to say that Sweeney Todd is by far his most famous work at this point. And I don't think a lot of people saw that coming, you know, years ago. But it's just so compelling, the story. You know, there are things about it that people would respond to who might not respond to, say, a little night music, because maybe they think that's a little too rarefied, you know, in terms of the characters, and maybe a little too too above them, you know. But this is a story about common people, and also it's got a lot of blood and violence in it to keep people interested who want that sort of thing. And it's a great mystery story. It's just got everything. So I think Sweeney Todd is, you know, it's up there with the great operas of Verdi and Puccini. It absolutely is.
I asked some of my friends who are not, you know, who I would consider theater people, and they seem to know the name Stephen Sondheim. So I wonder if, you know, he has, you know, made such inroads outside of the theater community that it will hold true over the next 100 years. I appreciate exactly what you're saying about the dumbing down, but hopefully with huge...
Well, yes, but that's why I use the word renaissance.
Yes,
I anticipate a renaissance will come. It seems to me that a lot of musical theater is like 100 years ago when it was frivolous and silly, and eventually somebody is going to say, oh, it's too frivolous and silly. Let's get serious about this. So if that happens... and I know that's a big if, but if it does happen, then Sondheim will be welcomed into the fold even more so than before, because his work will maintain its intelligence, of course. So I do think we have that to look forward to if there is a renaissance. If things keep on getting dumbing down, yeah, then that's another story entirely.
Well, and of course, you can look for signs in either direction. I mean, certainly. Certainly, Bridges in Madison County is a good sign, and I haven't seen If Then, so I don't know about the quality of it, but just the ambition of it and what they're trying to do, that's a good sign. I mean, there are shows like that to counteract, you know, Spider-Man and Million Dollar Quartet and things like that. So, you know.
Well, Michael mentioned it. Michael and I talked about the Bridges of Madison County last week, but Peter was off in Cincinnati. So, Peter, you saw it. So tell us a little bit of what you thought about Bridges.
I have a very different take on this show from most people, because something bothered me that doesn't seem to be bothering anybody else about Bridges of Madison County. And that is the fact that I've never seen a musical with so many phone calls, and I think that even includes bells ringing, and certainly never one with so many pay phone calls. And the thing is, The Bridges of Madison County takes place in 1965. And in those days, believe me when I'm telling you, those of you who are too young to either remember 1965 or weren't even around, making a long-distance phone call was a big event. It really was. I mean, you did not do this blithely. There were many ways that people got around making long-distance phone calls. Look, when I get to my destination, I'll call once, I'll hang up, I'll call again, I'll hang up after one ring, and then you'll know I arrived safely.
They were very expensive.
They really were. I mean, you know,
to carry tons of change.
Yeah, that too. I mean, you know, I will admit that is... around 65, I think they were using credit cards, that you gave your credit card number to the operator. But also, that was if you did that, that was a more expensive call. And I'm not sure these people in Iowa had these credit cards. It seems to me a little too highfalutin for these. We're in Iowa, right? Yeah, okay. I keep getting confused with Illinois, because they go to the Illinois State Fair, right? That's what it is. They're in Iowa, but they go to the Illinois State Fair, or is it the other way around? Anyway,
yes.
So, you know, I did a little research, and I found out that back in 1965, if you made a call, it was $1 a minute, which in terms of inflation now means you would pay $7.43 a minute. And that's a big tariff for every 60 seconds. I will admit that's up until 11 o'clock. There used to be phone calls that used to be made at 11 o'clock at night because the rates went to a little lower. And, you know, if I were Marsha Norman, I would have made a big deal of this. I would have really, had him call after 11 at night. I would have him do the thing with the call once, hang up, and call again and hang up again. Because if those two, if Francesca and Robert were in bed and the phone rang once, and then you didn't hear it, and then it rang again, and she knows exactly who it is, I think that would have been a very dramatic thing. Never does anybody in the show ever say, well, look, this is costing a fortune, I better get off right now. That never happens either, and I would think it would, you know? So I think that's very, very strange, that is totally irrelevant, that the phone calling is as blithe as it is today, where you can call New Delhi for a penny or whatever it is, you know? So I'm very, very surprised that that detail wasn't addressed.
Well, the only thing I could say to that is, weren't there, didn't it depend on how how far away you were from the other person? Weren't there all kinds of different zones and things?
Illinois and Iowa are quite different, you know, so.
I wasn't sure how far away they were supposed to be.
Yeah, well, those are two different states and they're not close. So I think, but again, not that we ever see that Hunter Foster's character, Bud, her husband, is a cheap man. There's still something about those old farmer type values that suggest not being flagrant big spenders. Right. So I think it's in character. It would have been in character for him to complain about the phone calls. What I like, by the way, about the writing that Marsha Norman does is that at one point on one of those expensive phone calls, he does say, "I wish I were there with you." And that's very nice. Rather than making him this insensitive bastard, he likes his wife. The real problem in Madison County is that marriage and children really can be quite a morass. And I thought it was really good early on after the family leaves. And she says, "At last, I have 3 days to myself, 3 whole days I'm doing nothing." And I understand that point of view. I've seen a lot of families where mothers can't believe this reprieve from the governor, almost, that they get this time off in which they're going to do nothing. Because running a household is really like running a company. And James, I probably don't have to tell you this. You have 2 kids, right?
Yes.
Yes. So you know what I'm talking about. I mean, it's always something is always happening. And what I thought was a really great detail is after they leave, the kids make a phone call home and complain about each other's behavior. I mean, they're gone and they're still not gone, you know. So I thought that was terrific. I like that. But, you know, I mean, marriage and children are a tough room to play. I mean, Katharine Hepburn famously said marriage isn't a word. It's a sentence, and it certainly seems it here. So it's not that. So you don't have to make Hunter Foster a bad guy. All he has to be is a husband of long standing, and all you have to have is 2 kids who I think are much too old looking for the kids they're supposed to be. They're supposed to be teenagers. They certainly don't look it to me. And you really have enough to drive somebody into somebody else's arms for just this escape and all that. So Stephen Pasquale's terrific. Kelly O'Hara's terrific. Yes, indeed. No question. The music sounds very pretty to me. I'm looking forward to hearing it again when the 2-disc set comes out. I thought that was good. I also liked a very controversial aspect of this production. That is that there are people all around moving scenery into place. And, I'm not very much of a practitioner of the idea of actors being tools in a box. But it worked for me here because the point seemed to be when you live in one of these small towns, people always know everything you're doing. They're always there. They never go away. You know, everybody knows everybody else's business. I have a friend who had a visitor late at night, and one thing led to another. But he had to throw her out because he knew that at 6:30, Karen and Jim were going to be jogging by his house and they would see her car there. You know, and I mean, that is small town life. You know, everybody knows what you're doing, you know, and he said she hasn't spoken to him since for throwing her out, you know. So, I mean, it ended up very sadly. But, you know, small town life, you know, you really pay for the fact that you just don't have the privacy because these poor souls in these small town don't have any live entertainment. So all the people in town become the live entertainment. You know, I mean, that's it. You know, I mean, you get immersed in their lives. They become your stars. You know, you're not going to find Audra McDonald there, you know. So you have to find these people who become people that you get interested in. You know everything about their lives. I will admit that there is the upside to that in which these people are willing to help. Just as in The Music Man, Meredith Wilson has his people say, but we'll give you a shirt and a back to go with it. Mm-hmm. You know, that's true. You know, but it also gives them a strange type of license to therefore to have their face in your business every step of the way. And that's a bit of a problem. So I think this is a worthwhile show. I hope it catches on. We'll see if it does. It's going to be interesting to see, of course, in one of the hottest Best Actress Tony races in years, whether Kelly O'Hara will get the prize because a lot of people feel she's been denied it too many times already. I mean, I'm not saying she's not wonderful in the role. She is. But there's a lot of wonderful people in roles this year, or at least we presume there will be. So I guess this is a good time as any to mention the leading lady of If Then, who a week ago wasn't as famous as she is now. So she should really bless John Travolta like crazy for making her a household name. It's the best thing that could have ever happened to her. Right. So anyway, but there are so many other magnificent performances we either have seen or expect to see in the Best Actress category for a musical. So I will be interested to see if this is Kelly's year, because other years have not been.
Well, I last week when we talked about The Bridges of Madison County, I talked about how much I loved the show. And in my opinion, if this show fails, it's a failure of marketing. I think that everybody in the creative side has done everything possible to get the product on stage that I think many audiences would like. And if it doesn't sell, then I think it's not marketed well.
Shouldn't that title enough be of a marketing?
But I think that people are just depending upon the title. And in a season where you have Beautiful, where you have If Then, where you have so many other things happening, and Audra just throwing her hat into the ring, going into Circle in the Square. Yeah. I think that it's a crowded market, and it's you have Rocky. Rocky's going to take all the air out of the room when it comes to talking about Broadway once it opens.
Well, conceivably, Rocky is the only other title that has as
Bullets much, Over Broadway,
as much name recognition as The Bridges of Madison County. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, Bullets Over Broadway was a moderately successful movie, and I love it dearly. Right. By the way, it's by far my favorite Woody Allen movie, and not just because it deals with the theater, because it really says something very interesting, and that is a true artist is willing to die for his art, and that's what's wonderful about Bullets Over Broadway. That said, though, with all those millions upon millions upon millions of copies sold of that popular movie, I would say The Bridges of County has built-in marketing just from those titles. Unless it's a case where people are just sick and tired of it. And that could very well be.
Maybe. I've heard several people complain about the various marketing and commercials. Someone said there was one commercial that someone said compared to a Summer's Eve commercial. I mean, it's hard to, given the nature of the story, and you know, people have thrown big brickbats at it ever since it was a book, and then again when it was a movie. But I thought it actually gained some respect in the movie because of the amazing work of Meryl Streep primarily, and also Clint Eastwood, even though he was way too old for the role, and also the direction of it, his direction of it, I thought was extraordinary. But I did want to ask Peter if I could. I did have a crazy idea for The Bridges, the musical. You know, on the one hand, we understand exactly why they wanted to make it a community story, as you said, and they wanted to spend so much time on the kids and the husband and the neighbors and all of that. But on the other hand, a lot of people seem to feel that material isn't as compelling. And so my question is, would it have been interesting to have all of those characters and all of them material in the show, but not to musicalize them at all and leave the singing only to Robert and Francesca?
I like that approach quite a bit. I've seen it used in other shows that there are some people who simply do not have any music in them, and therefore they should not sing. So I agree with you. That would be an excellent approach.
Oh, have you seen? I mean, I can think of a very few examples. It's not something that's done that often, but I think it can be.
No, it isn't. No,
it can be very, very powerful.
Yes, it can.
Yeah.
Yeah, I remember seeing an adaptation of a Maxwell Anderson play, The Star Wagon, where there was no music whatsoever in certain sections because the scenes indicated these people had no music in them. And for that matter, to a slight degree, one could argue that Lady in the Dark does that too. Because it's only the fantasy sequences that we see come alive with music, because there's very little music in that lady's life and in that office.
And she doesn't get to sing. She doesn't get to sing as herself until she sings My Ship at the end.
Yeah. So.
Oh, I'm sorry. I was talking to a muted mic. So
we were wondering if you were just
I was stunned. I was stunned into silence
at our brilliance.
Although Michael, last week when you talked about it, I was less warm to the idea, but now that I hear it again, I think that maybe that you have a winner there.
I mean, can you imagine how effective, like if every time anyone else came, there was just dialogue, and then whenever they were alone or together with each other, that's the only time you heard singing. Mm-hmm. This goes back to my idea of, for the Umbrellas of Cherbourg, I think I may have mentioned it to you, when I actually got to see a stage production of it. But I had felt this from the film previously. The Umbrellas of Cherbourg, for those who don't know, is through sung, completely through sung, no dialogue whatsoever. But then the couple breaks up and he goes off to war, and then there's a blackout, whether it's the film or the stage version. And then the lights come up again, and it's many years later, and the guy is working at a gas station, and who pulls up in a limo with her daughter, but his former lover, several years later. And I always thought that it would have been, in the film and in the show, the show with lyrics by Sheldon Harnick, because he did an adaptation and translation, in the show that final scene is also musicalized. But I said to him one night, wouldn't it be amazing if that final scene was played as a dialogue scene? You know, all of the music has gone out of their lives, and now they're just regular people. You know,
what did he say?
He thought it was a great idea.
It was a great idea. Good for you.
Yeah,
that's
an
excellent idea. My hat's off to you for thinking.
Oh well, thanks. Yeah, well, I mean, who knows if unfortunately this show does not, and I'm hearing bad things about the box office receipts. I don't check the grosses. I never do. But that's what I'm hearing second and third hand. But maybe if it doesn't fly, maybe they could try. Maybe they could try that other version. I don't know.
Yeah, the grosses have not been good as far as what was expected, especially with a lot of other big names opening up soon and things happening.
Well, that's part of it. I'm also hearing that Rocky is not doing nearly as well as everyone expected. But and that's interesting, because I don't think that would be a review show. I don't think the fortunes of that show are going to be dependent on the reviews. So if they are great, I don't know if that will necessarily help them so much, and if they're terrible, I don't know if it'll necessarily hurt them that much. But we'll also know, we'll know the answers to all these questions will soon be revealed.
Yeah, so Bridges, they're doing, last week they did 390 out of a potential just over a million, so they're, you know, playing, you know, 38% or so, which is very problematic for a large show like that.
I'll say.
So hopefully, I really believe that there is a place on Broadway for this show. I agree. I believe that if this show doesn't succeed, it's a 100% marketing failure. It's terrible. All right. So let's talk about something else. Let's see. I have my rundown here, and I have lost it. So Tenderloin. Peter got a chance to see Tenderloin. So Peter, why don't you tell us about that?
Well, I mean, it's a nice segue from Sheldon Harnick and the Umbrellas of Cherbourg, because Sheldon Harnick was the lyricist on Tenderloin. As Hal Prince said in his book Contradictions, all of us had such a good time working on Fiorello that we had to get back together again. So it was much of the Fiorello cast, crew. We had George Ebbett and Jerome Wideman. We certainly had Jerry Bock, Sheldon Harnick, and the same producers, Griffith and Prince, as they were billed in those days. So Tenderloin has always suffered because, as Walter Kerr said in his opening night review, The numbers in the whorehouse were so much fun, you really couldn't get behind Reverend Brock wanting to close them down, because after all, you were having such fun while you were there. So this has been a problematic show, and it was one that always intoxicated me, because I think the original cast album is spectacular. I will say that the Encores recording that was made sometime later, I think, is even better. That's a Minority Report, by the way. But as somebody who always felt the Capitol cast albums didn't sound nearly as good as Columbia or RCA, I like the immediacy of the, I think it was DRG who did the one that was done in Encores. So it took me 37 years to see a production of Tenderloin. And in that time, I've since seen four in the last 15 years or so. So, but I always like going to see if they can lick this, the central problem, and that is of having this guy who wants to close these brothels for religious reasons. And late in the show, he does bring up it's a place that's unhealthy, and it's a place where crime certainly is gives birth. So, you know, I wish that came in a little earlier, that he was really concerned about the physical health of these people as well as the religious health of these people. I think it would make him a bit more sympathetic. Here we had Mark Jacoby instead of Maurice Evans. Maurice Evans had to have been a disaster. I didn't see him, but he sounds so portentous on the cast album, exactly what you hate about people in the religious right, you know, like that finger in the air type of Sodom and Gomorrah doom. So Mark Jacoby was a little more charming. Frankly, if I were doing Tenderloin, I would cast a very young man as Reverend Brock, because there's something about being old that makes you seem cantankerous, and that you don't want anybody else to have fun because you're old. All those values come in there. So I would like to see it done with a young man. And at least Mark Jacoby felt much younger than Maurice Evans sounds in the recording. Another problem, too, with the recording, I mean, this is, again, is a Minority Report, because a lot of people like Ron Usman's voice. He plays Tommy. Tommy is a double agent. He's working for the cops, but he also ostensibly is working for Dr. Brock. And it takes him a long time to make a decision on who he's really for. And unfortunately, Balkenhainer didn't write, or at least George Abbott wouldn't put it in the show, a song where he has his epiphany about doing the right thing. And the show would profit from that. If the show would profit because the score is so wonderful, I would think a song like that by Balkenhainer would have been spectacular too. So, but anyway, Tommy here was played by Max von Essen, one of our most valuable current contemporary artists, and he was very winning in the role. And he didn't do the type of thing that I was talking about earlier, which Ron Usman did, which was show off the voice and not have any character involved in it whatsoever. So Max von Essen really got into the character of Tommy when he sang. And that made a great deal of difference as well. So it's a tough show because, you know, how does it end? I mean, eventually they throw Reverend Brock out of town and he winds up in Detroit. Of course, one of the reasons he winds up in Detroit is because there's a song called Little Old New York that starts the show, and he winds up in Little Old Detroit. And, you know, it's hard to find those cities where the emphasis is on the second syllable. Bajur does the same thing. Move over, New York, New York. And then later, move over, Detroit, Detroit. Because really, I mean, when you think of it, there aren't that many cities where the emphasis is on the second syllable. Compton and Green used Cape Cod when they were doing this song, What a Waste. But, you know, such cities are few and far between. Anyway, the idea that they run the preacher out of town and he has to go somewhere else isn't quite a satisfying resolution. But I'm telling you, this score is just terrific beyond belief. It really is arguably, and yes, I've heard them all, arguably their best score. And I mean, you know, then you say to yourself, no, that can't be true. I mean, look at She Loves Me. Look at Fiddler. I mean, you know, it is crazy to say that, but even the Rothschilds is magnificent. So, but it's really very well sung here, and that's what's really something. I went Friday night. Now, this was really the first official performance And when you think of it, you know, they only have 32 hours of rehearsal when they go to Mufti. That's it. It was amazing how everybody was in the right place at the right time. There were no flubs, anything like that, and it was being sung beautifully. I'd like to think that's happening because everybody knows the score so well that they've been listening to it since they were children. But I guess that's wishful thinking. So we also had some very nice people involved. Besides Mark Jacoby and Max von Essen, we also had Jen Cody playing Margie, which, by the way, was originally played by Marjorie Gray, who caught Sheldon Harnick's eye during the tryout, and they wound up being married in 1961, and they're still married today, which is really quite lovely. Michael McCormick played the corrupt police official. We've had good times with him over the years. But, you know, really, Katie Rose Clark was so wonderful as Laura. That's the woman who tries to straighten out Tommy and tries to let him see that he's not on the right path and that none of his lies, none of his I come from a great background, none of those grandiose statements are remotely true. And she tries to get him to be a nice person. And her influence certainly is felt as time goes on. But she was quite lovely. And the cast was really, really something. And I'm very glad that Tenderloin got redeemed as much as it did. It's never going to be a perfect show. It's one of the reasons Encore was chosen way back when, because it would be very, very hard to get people to go to this 8 times a week. But boy, if you Lord knows when this is broadcast, it will have closed because Mufti only does a weekend. But nevertheless, for those of you who do not know the cast album of Tenderloin, and I recommend the second one, not the first, but if you can only get the first, take it, because it really has the sound of the turn of the century, 1890s. I didn't make clear that's when it takes place. It really has that wonderful sound. These guys could really write for the era that they were in, and this is the era they were in, and they knew how to do it. So a couple of wrong notes here and there, and I mean that as a compliment, that really make the music even more interesting. And by the way, even though you didn't quite hear it at Mufti, because they want to get going, one of the great overtures of all time. Seriously. I can't imagine making a list of the 20 greatest overtures of all time and not including Tenderloin. So definitely worthwhile. And I'm delighted to have seen it for the fourth time in the last 14, 15 years.
All right. Well, that sounds great. I wanted to... We've talked about the York Theatre Company a number of times over the last 5 years or so that we've done this recordings, but I love their mission statement. I want to read it again just for 2014's sake. The mission statement of the York Theatre Company is to be a birthplace for the new literate, intimate musicals, and a place where underappreciated musical gems from the past are rediscovered. To provide the support for the creators of new musical theater, to be the showcase for new musical theater talent of all kinds, to provide students with opportunities for hands-on theater education, and to serve the community by presenting free or low-cost musical theater performances to underserved audiences. Isn't that a great mission statement?
It sure is. They accomplish it, no question. While I was there the other night, a woman came up to me and said, "Oh, please, April 28th, my musical about Monet is going to be here. 3 o'clock in the afternoon, will you please come?" And I said, "Sure." So, you know, really, they do give a lot of readings during the year. They get a lot of things to happen. And it's a rare musical theater fan who doesn't keep his eye out to see what these Muftis are going to be. Because for many of us, this gives us a chance to see the musicals of yore that we were either too young or weren't around to see. So it's very valuable in that way, too. Also, Jim Morgan, who runs the place, gives very entertaining pre-show speeches. They're shows in themselves.
Well, that offers us a segue to Musicals Tonight, another group that does. They tend to, except in maybe really rare circumstances, they do not do new shows, but they definitely dust off all kinds of wonderful old shows that hardly anyone else ever does. And the one they're doing right now is Little Mary Sunshine, which I'm sure many of our listeners know is a delightful operetta spoof by Rick Bassoyan that originally played, not sure the exact, early 60s, late 50s, sometime around there, with Eileen Brennan who died not long ago and was actually in the In Memoriam tribute at the Oscars this year as Little Mary. And it's really a lot of fun. So I would definitely check that out if you like that show. You're not going to have many opportunities to see it. This one, I'm happy to say, it has quite the production values are tend to be somewhat limited because of budget at Musicals Tonight. But in this case, they have quite wonderful, beautiful costumes, especially for the men with these wonderful red coats, and Little Mary has quite a get up. So it's fun. I take photos for the Musicals Tonight. I take their production photos. So I only got to see the first act, but I think you'll have a really good time. And especially if you have an affection for the operetta form, it's something that's really going to be really going to be enjoyable for you.
All right. So you're keeping yourself very, very busy, taking production photos, doing all your other stuff, and reviewing and seeing Sweeney.
Yes.
All of that.
Yes. And also saw, I have to mention, Jim Caruso, Cast Party Goes to the Movies. That was the title of it. It was a special edition of Jim Caruso's Cast Party. The Cast Party is an event I'm sure we've talked about that happens every Monday night, normally at Birdland on 44th Street. And it's basically an open mic event where people can get up and you arrive there. You go to speak with Jim and you see if you can get on the list at some point. And then you get up and do whatever your specialty is, playing an instrument, singing, I suppose comedy. I think they have comedians. Not much room to dance there, but pretty much anything else. Mm-hmm. So you get all kinds of people of all different abilities. But it's not the kind of place that you tend to get, gong show type people, because people realize what level they're working at, and they look around and see how good everyone else is. So it's very, very rare that you get someone who gets up there who does not know what they're doing. And then you will occasionally, more than occasionally, get really famous people to get up and sing a number, from Marilyn May to Liza Minnelli. So it's quite an event. But they did a special one-night-only version of it at the Allen Room, which we've discussed many, many times, the beautiful Allen Room at the Time Warner Center as part of the Jazz at Lincoln Center series. But the big news there is I'm going into the room and I see this huge lit logo up on the wall next to it, and it says Appel Room, APPEL Room. And I was like, I'm a little disoriented. So I went over to the usher as I went in, and I said, it says Appel Room. I said, when did that happen? And I think she thought I said, why did that happen? So she said, well, a significant donation was made. And then I said, oh, no, I'm sorry. I said, when did it happen? And she said, oh, I think it was just last week. And in fact, it was so new that the people on stage, including Jim Caruso, kept referring to it as the Allen Room. So I don't even know if they realized it. But yeah, I'll have to find out a little bit more about who this who these Appel people are, and who, for that matter, I'm really not sure who the Allen Room was named after. But at any rate, the room is just spectacular and remains a destination in itself. And this show was great. They had the guests were Christina Bianco, that amazing, amazingly talented Forbidden Broadway veteran. Also, she's been in musical, and she's become something of an internet sensation lately, doing her various impressions of various different people singing Let It Go from Frozen. And she's just amazing. And they also had Jeffrey Denman, Natalie Douglas, the aforementioned Marilyn May, Jane Monheit, and Clark Thorell, who's done a lot of shows, with Billy Stritch at the piano and David Katzenberg on bass and Daniel Glass on drums. And Jim was the affable host, as always. So that was a really fun, another fun New York night.
With us this morning, we have a very special guest. Karen Ziemba is joining us. And I can't thank her enough, not only because it's daylight savings time, but because she's giving us a few minutes out of her schedule I want to say mere hours before they go into previews for Bullets Over Broadway, which she is appearing in. So, Karen, thank you so much for joining us on a Sunday morning.
I'm so glad to talk to you guys this morning.
Absolutely. So for fans out there, I'm just going to run down a little list of shows that people may have heard of. A Chorus Line, 42nd Street, Teddy and Alice, Crazy for You, Chicago, Steel Pier, Contact, Never Gonna Dance, Curtains, and the upcoming Bullets Over Broadway. These are things that you have put your heart and soul into. So that's quite a list, Karen.
Yeah, I know. A lot of them start with the letter C. I don't know why that is. It's weird, but they just happen to. This one, of course, is the B one. But Bullets Over Broadway is it's been so highly anticipated for a long time, and I was one of the last people to be cast in the show in the principal cast, and so when I was offered it after I had done an audition for the creative team and went on tape for Woody Allen, so he could, because he didn't know me, of course, and I'd never been in one of his films. And so after I had heard that he gave the high sign, said, yep, she's the one for this character, I called a couple of my friends who were in the cast and said, so what's the deal? Tell me what's going on and how you feel about this show and the people involved and just the show itself, the content. And they were just so ecstatic about it. And these were people that I knew would shoot from the hip and not, you know, beat around the bush or say, like, you know, make it, you know, Gilda Lily. You know, they were definitely going to say something, honest about it. And so after their reaction, which was so positive, I thought, okay, this is it. It would be wonderful to be part of this, if nothing else, just to be with these people and to do a piece of Woody Allen's and to work with Susan Stroman again, because she's been one of my champions, of course. And so there you have it.
Who do you play?
I play a character named Eden Brent, who is the actress who is in the play within the play of Bullets Over Broadway. There's the playwright, David Shane, played by Zach Braff, is has written this play, and Julian Marks, played by Lenny Walpe, the producer, is putting together his cast along with one of the other investors, played by Vinny Pastor from The Sopranos, playing the guy with the money, the mobster with the money, and he wants his girlfriend in the show, so they're all kind of producing it together. But I'm one of Julian Marks's favorite actresses. I'm in all of his shows. I'm like his lucky charm. And myself and Warner, played by Brooke Sashmanskas, is also like a journeyman actor who is in a lot of Julian Marks's plays. And so we kind of go along with it. And I'm a little zany, and but Julian really likes me, so he lets me bring my little mascot along with me all the time, my Mr. Wuffles, my little Pomeranian. And it's just a bunch of very eccentric characters in this play.
All right, so you've been working with a dog.
Oh, yes.
Uh-huh. And do you naturally take to dogs?
Oh, yes, I've had dogs for years in my growing up, and then also I just lost our Norwich Terrier a couple of years ago, McDuff, but he lived to be almost 17 years old.
That's pretty good.
So
yeah.
He had a good long life. But I hadn't actually been on stage with dogs ever before in this capacity,
mm-hmm.
So I had to bond with them early on, and it was a great learning experience. The great Bill Berlone, who is like the dog handler of the canine Broadway stars.
right, indeed.
He's been doing it for like, 30 years or more.
Almost 40,
yeah, with Annie and Legally Blonde and just every show, all the Wizard of Oz's. He's got They have like, I don't know, 10 Totos running around on that farm up there. it's really fascinating, you know, the work he does. And it's been interesting that being part of my journey with doing Bullets Over Broadway, that was also part of my task. It was to bond with little Trixie. And she's just beautiful. She's just a beautiful little princess. And everybody, whenever I'm holding her, everybody just sort of gravitates toward me. You can't help it because she's so beautiful.
Of course, Helen Sinclair doesn't much like the dog in the original movie.
Her in the play either.
I see. Okay. All right. It's not an original score. What songs do you have that we know?
There's some really great tunes in this. You guys, you'll love it. It's Runnin' Wild.
Mm-hmm.
Take Nobody's Business If I Do.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
Up a Lazy River.
Mm-hmm.
I Found a New Baby.
Mm-hmm.
She's Funny That Way.
Good.
A New Day Coming. So there's some very obscure ones too.
Good.
You know, it's funny you mentioned, I didn't realize, I saw the film, but not since it came out. The producer's name is Julian Marks.
I know.
Which is very close to Julian Marsh in 42nd
Street.
I'm
wondering if that was on purpose.
An homage, yeah.
Uh-huh. There's a couple of things that you'll pick out in this play that I think are that Woody wanted to definitely pinpoint something that was in his past that stood out, which would be an homage to something about show business.
Mm. So is Woody actively involved in the rehearsal process with you guys?
He comes in once in a while to observe and to give us notes, to put his two cents in. We had a run through before we got into the theater. He was right smack in the center, front row, so we were all a little bit nervous. And he's very quiet and shy, so he doesn't really show much. He doesn't really smile. He's just like really paying attention and listening. So you don't know exactly what he's thinking. But afterwards, I spoke to him and I said hello and. He said, I'm going to join you for a note session later. Brace yourself. I think he was making a joke, but it was, and then he went down to his yellow legal pad. But he was actually, when I met him the first time at the meet and greet, he was really lovely. And Susan Stroman, you know, told me, you know, don't expect, you know, that he's going to be, typically, hey, you know, that kind of, this is not his way. So, but he actually was very lovely and very kind and said congratulations and welcome and smiled. He was very, very sweet. But he was in rehearsal the other day watching some of the rehearsal in the theater and seemed to be enjoying himself. And he was at our Sitz Probe where we hear the orchestra for the first time and was enjoying it very much. And that's, of course, as everybody knows, the Sitz Probe where you hear the full orchestra play the score for the first time is one of the most exciting parts of
sure.
You know, before you open, because it just finishes the picture. It just completes, you know, the entire pie.
Karen, and, can I take you back to St. Joseph, Michigan?
Oh, sure.
So tell us, how does a girl from St. Joseph, Michigan end up at the University of Akron and then onto the Ohio Ballet and then into New York?
Well,
it's very 42nd Street, sort of.
Yes, it sort of is. Yeah. Allentown.
Yes.
St. Joe, Michigan is where my father's people came from, or I should say came from after they left Germany. And so my name is Polish, but my father is German-speaking because they lived in a part of Germany that was used to be part of Poland and now was occupied by Germany. So a lot of these people who were from that area moved to Western Michigan. And a lot of them, of course, are in Chicago and Milwaukee, that whole area. And my father, my paternal grandmother played the piano, and my maternal grandmother was an opera singer. She sang the city opera. You guys probably knew that because we've talked about that before. So there was a lot of music in my house, and all my brothers also were played instruments and sang. We all sang and played instruments, but I was the one that was given the dance lessons because my mother always wanted to be a dancer. She wanted to be Eleanor Powell, Ginger Rogers, and all those chicks. So she was raising a family, so she gave that to me, and that's how that happened, and I just really loved it, and I obviously got a lot of attention that way, and so I kept it up and just really excelled at it and became a ballet dancer and wanted to be a concert dancer, but then came to realize that I didn't, that wasn't how I could fully express myself, and because I love to sing and do pratfalls and do all that other kind of stuff, the theater just made itself, you know, it was obvious to me that that's the track that I was going to take. So I, through my great dance training, it helped me get into the musical theater, and the singing just was, of course, that was an added plus. Because when I started getting into the musical theater, casts began to get smaller, and the dancers and singers had to be one person. There was no dancing chorus and singing chorus. It was everybody had to do everything. You know, you had like in a cast of, you know, like a, my first production I did was a production of My Fair Lady. There was four girls and four guys, and we had to play all the other characters in it. You know, the buskers, the maids, you know, the Ascot Gavotte, snooty people, everybody. So, but anyway, back to what you were saying about St. Joe. So I just, I joined the ballet company when I was in college at the University of Akron. I went there because they had a really great dance department. And my a friend of mine had gone there who actually got into being a lighting designer, because the ballet company, the Ohio Ballet there, which was a wonderful regional ballet company, performed right there in town, but they also performed all over the country. At that time in the 70s, there was like a great regional ballet company in every, you know, decent town. In, you know, they had one in Hartford, Dayton, Cincinnati, Milwaukee. They all had ballet companies. Now, of course, because of funding from the National Endowment for the Arts, all those have disbanded, and there are very few anymore. So, but at that time, that was what I, where I was going. But I'm glad that I chose to do the musical theater, because I've been very, very happy and blessed to have a wonderful career and meet some really incredible people.
How did you end up in Chorus Line?
Oh, I was doing a show at the Radio City Music Hall, their 50th anniversary show. I was not a Rockette, but at that time they also had a whole like kind of singing and dancing ensemble along with the Rockettes. They did these big shows in the summertime, and I just went to, I got an audition for one of the tours that was still out, and they needed to replace a character who had, in a Chorus Line, when you played a role on the road, you not only played that role, but you had to understudy other roles. So I had the ability to play quite a few different characters. So I got that job and was on the road for a little while. And then when that was done, I was home in New York, and a role opened up on Broadway that I happened to play, that I knew. It was in my repertoire, as it were. And they went, get Ziemba, you know, I think she's available. So I played Deanna Morales for a month on Broadway, and they just kept me in the company because I played so many different roles. And then I got to play Cassie, and eventually came back to do Bibi Benzenheimer, and I played a lot of those roles. So, but that was a wonderful show to start with, because that's really what my life is all about.
So Morales, I guess that's non-traditional casting.
That is very non-traditional casting. The guy that I stood next to who played Paul San Marco, he said, Karen, he says, I know you're playing a Puerto Rican, but you don't have to wear those big gold hoop earrings. I didn't know. I was trying to be more, you know, Latino, and it was like, no, just be yourself. You don't have to, you know. Don't push the envelope.
You know, Karen, they just had I didn't see it, unfortunately. They had a big reunion celebration concert of Titanic.
Yes.
And
yes.
I'm just hoping that maybe someday we'll get another show from that same season, Steel Pure.
I know. I have a feeling that that's going to have another life. I really do, because the score is so good in that.
So good. So. Yeah.
Was your first time you work with Susan on Crazy for You?
No, and The World Goes Round.
Oh, right. Oh. Yeah.
Where did you do that?
Review at the West Side Theater.
Right.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, that was the first time. And then from there was Crazy for You, because when Mike Ockrent, the director Mike Ockrent, saw Susan Stroman's work in And the World Goes Round. That's when he decided to hire her as his choreographer for Crazy for You.
I remember that, how much I loved that show. And I remember going to whoever the press agent was, I don't remember, and I said, you know, I think this is the best review I've ever seen. What kind of response are you getting from other people? And she said, pretty much the same as what you just said.
Yeah, that was a fabulous show, and it's been done like all over the place.
Robert Puccioli, Karen Mason?
Right.
Yeah.
Brenda Presley. Yeah.
Jimmy Walton and myself.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was tremendous. Talk about a great amount of songs. It was I didn't know that much about Candor and Ebb, of course, other than like Cabaret and things like that. I mean, and then of course getting to know them personally, and then the Rink, and all these other things that they had done. Some of their earlier works, of course, 70 Girl 70. And even stuff John Kander had done without Freddie, like A Family Affair, and some of these things were on my radar. And that was a wonderful bond to make, too, with those two incredible gentlemen.
Well, I do hope we see Steel Pier again in some form. I guess it's much more difficult to do in a one-night concert thing because there's so much choreography.
Yeah,
in
right.
There is. It really was a lot about the dancing.
Yeah.
And, but yeah, and where Titanic was more of this beautiful music.
Right, right.
So
then you, a few years later, put on a yellow dress.
No, I put on the blue dress.
Oh, the blue dress.
Yes. Everybody says that. Were you the girl in the yellow dress? I say no, but I won the Tony Award.
That's right.
That ends the conversation right there.
Win. That's so funny. No, that was like, yeah.
Where do you keep it? Where do you keep the Tony now?
Oh, the Tony is now, because of the construction going on here, is behind. I've covered up all of our wonderful shelves of books and music and things to protect it. So it's hiding behind there. But it is sitting along with some of my other wonderful things that I've collected over the years. And, you know, some of this stuff you have to eventually discard, but... You know, the drama desks and the, these things that people give you to, you know, that are recognition of you, of your, their thanks for you for the work that you've done are very important to me. And so they kind of like stay on display on their own little shelf.
So your experience in Contact, as you mentioned, garnered you much accolades there, and
yeah.
Well deserved. So what was your experience like in Contact? It was such a I want to say a non-traditional show.
Very much so. I went to see Susan Stroman was working very closely with Lincoln Center Theater. It was sort of became this place where she could play and work as an artist, and they were very allowed her to try new things. And she came down there with this, I don't know, this 40-minute piece that took place in a dance club. And that was what the second act of Contact was, the part that starred Boyd Gaines, and there was the girl in the yellow dress and all the other dancers, where he, you know, the guy wants to commit suicide, and he goes to this dance club, and he meets this woman, and it changes his life. Okay. So I saw a run-through of that in the basement at Lincoln Center, and I thought, wow, this is incredible, this piece. It was moving, but it was also, like, choreographically just incredible. You know, Stroman at the top of her game. And then later she said, KZ, I'm going to send you these cassette tapes with this music on. I want you to listen to it because I'm thinking of, you know, putting a couple more pieces together with this piece that you just saw to make a full evening of theater. And she sent me these tapes, and it was all this like classical, you know, Tchaikovsky, Bizet, all this like kind of almost ballet opera music. And I was like, what is this? That doesn't go with this other jazzy, you know, swing dancing music. I said, that doesn't make any sense. I said, Stro, this is ballet. What is? She goes, yes, that's right. I was like, uh-oh. Put on your ballet, back your ballet slippers, Casey. And that's when I thought to myself, thank God I had all that incredible dance training, because she really wanted me to do this whole thing as this woman who, when she went into her fantasy, she became this beautiful ballerina, and or thought she was the belle of the ball. And so that's what that was all about. And the thing was so great about that show, it was, I think, the melding of, you know, Stroh's, you know, just her incredible creativity, and the people that she cast in that show were like meant to play those characters, that they were molded for us. And I think when you have the show, the character, and everything kind of comes together, that's when you really stand out. So I felt that it really just fit me like a glove, and I think that's what made it so special. And why the accolades came. It was also just the combination of all putting all the right pieces together. And that's, you know, what makes a great role for somebody. It's also the show that you're in, the piece that surrounds your performance, has a lot to do with just how you stand out, how a person can stand out. But it was quite heady, because it started out, I remember reading the script, and it had very little dialogue in it. Mm-hmm. And I gave it to a friend to read who was a playwright, and they said, you know, this is very unusual. You say very little, but what you say is very funny and very clear and spare. And it turned out to be so true. And I had people come see the run through and say, like, do you like this? Is this something I should continue doing? They said, oh, Karen, you're very good in it, and it's really moving. I think you should continue on with this project. It was hard to tell from the outside, you know. Mm-hmm. You show up, you do your work, but it's what people are seeing and feeling that's the most important. And that's why doing shows, you have to get, you know, the right people in the room to be honest. And that's why you take shows out of town as much as you can, because you have to get it in front of human beings and see what their response is. But that was a good one. That was definitely a winner for me.
So, Karen, you are you going into previews on Tuesday?
Mm-hmm.
Two days from now. So
yes, we're so excited. It's, you know, the first downbeat of that orchestra is like, you feel like you're in another world. You feel like you're in another time. It's like being at the Cotton Club. The way that Doug Besterman's orchestrations in the show are phenomenal. It's really great. I think you'd have a lot of fun, and you know, gangsters and showgirls and the whole bit. It's delightful.
Well, the three of us will definitely come and see you, and we hope to have you back on and tell us how it's been. All righty.
All right.
Thanks for joining us again, and break a leg.
Oh, thanks so much,
yes,
guys. Great talking to you.
Take care.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
All right, so let's wrap it up for today. I want to remind everybody that you can subscribe to these podcasts by going to the front page of BroadwayRadio.com. There's a subscribe link. That way, each and every time we have a new episode of This Week on Broadway, it'll be automatically downloaded to iTunes for you. If you don't want to listen to us in iTunes, you can listen to us in another way. One of them is a Stitcher app, which is an application for your iPhone, your BlackBerry, Android device. And that way we will be streamed automatically to you, so you don't have to sync it. You can also listen to us on Broadway World Radio. Broadway World plays us Wednesdays at noon, Thursdays at 7 p.m., and Saturdays at 2 p.m. Contact information for Peter, Michael, and me can be found at BroadwayRadio.com, as well as links to some of the things we've talked about today. So on behalf of Michael Portantier and Peter Felicia, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening to Broadway Videos This Week on Broadway. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Much for the sound, I'm willing to ride. There's the Ferris wheel, a miracle, that circle of steel. It's funny how nervous it's making me feel, yet willing to ride. This time, although I'll do it, I swear it's the last time I'll ever put myself
and now must be now, and then must be then. I'm learning to quiet that butterfly riot inside. I'm willing to ride. Must be now, and then must be then. I've struck out before, and I couldn't forget if I tried.